In fact, it did contain a dining table, or more strictly, a breakfast table. And round the breakfast table, glowing in the sunlight and evident to the street, were a group of noisy and talkative men, all dressed in the insolence of fashion, with white waistcoats and expensive buttonholes. Some of their jokes could almost be heard across the square. Then the grave secretary gave his unnatural smile, and Syme knew that this boisterous breakfast party was a secret conclave of the European dynamiters. Then, as Syme continued to stare at them, he saw something that he had not seen before. He had not seen it literally because it was too large to see. At the nearest end of the balcony, blocking up a great part of the perspective, was the back of a great mountain of a man. When Syme had seen him, his first thought was that the weight of him must break down the balcony of stone. His vastness did not lie only in the fact that he was abnormally tall and quite incredibly fat. This man was planned enormously in his original proportions, like a statue carved deliberately as colossal. His head, crowned with white hair, as seen from behind, looked bigger than a head ought to be. The ears that stood out from it looked larger than human ears. He was enlarged terribly to scale, and this sense of size was so staggering that when Syme saw him, all the other figures seemed quite suddenly to dwindle and become dwarfish. They were still sitting there as before with their flowers and frock coats, but now it looked as if the big man was entertaining 5 children to tea. As Syme and the guide approached the side door of the hotel, a waiter came out smiling with every tooth in his head. "The gentlemen are up there, sire," he said. "They do talk and they do laugh at what they talk. They do say they will throw bombs at the king." And the waiter hurried away with a napkin over his arm, much pleased with the singular frivolity of the gentlemen upstairs. The two men mounted the stairs in silence. Syme had never thought of asking whether the monstrous man who almost filled and broke the balcony was the great president of whom the others stood in awe. He knew it was so, with an unaccountable but instantaneous certainty. Syme, indeed, was one of those men who are open to all the more nameless psychological influences in a degree a little dangerous to mental health. Utterly devoid of fear and physical dangers, he was a great deal too sensitive to the smell of spiritual evil. Twice already that night, little unmeaning things had peeped out at him almost purulently and given him a sense of drawing nearer and nearer to the headquarters of hell, and this sense became overpowering as he drew nearer to the great president. The form it took was childish and yet hateful fancy. As he walked across the inner room toward the balcony, the large face of Sunday grew larger and larger, and Syme was gripped with a fear that when he was quite close the face would be too big to be possible, and that he would scream aloud. He remembered that as a child he would not look at the mask of Memnon in the British Museum, because it was a face, and so large. By an effort, braver than that of leaping over a cliff, he went to an empty seat at the breakfast table and sat down. The men greeted him with good-humored raillery as if they had always known him. He sobered himself a little by looking at their conventional coats and solid, shining coffee pot. Then he looked at Sunday again. His face was very large, but it was still possible to humanity. In the presence of the president, the whole company looked sufficiently commonplace. Nothing about them caught the eye at first, except that, by the president's caprice, they had been dressed up with a festive respectability, which gave the meal the look of a wedding breakfast. One man, indeed, stood out at even a superficial glance. He, at least, was the common or garden dynamiter. He wore, indeed, the high white collar and satin tie that were the uniform of the occasion. But out of his collar there sprang a head quite unimaginable and quite unmistakable, a bewildering bush of brown hair and beard that almost obscured the eyes like those of a Skye terrier. But the eyes did look out of the tangle, and they were the sad eyes of some Russian serf. The effect of this figure was not terrible like that of the president, but it had every diablerie that can come from the utterly grotesque. If out of that stiff tie and collar there had come abruptly the head of a cat or a dog, it could not have been more idiotic contrast. The man's name, it seems, was Gogol. He was a Pole, and in this circle of days he was called Tuesday. His soul and speech were incurably tragic. He could not force himself to play the prosperous and frivolous part demanded of him by President Sunday. And indeed, when Syme came in, the president, with that daring disregard of public suspicion which was his policy, was actually chafing Gogol upon his inability to assume conventional graces. "Our friend Tuesday," said the president in a deep voice at once of quietude and volume, "our friend Tuesday doesn't seem to grasp the idea. He dresses up like a gentleman, but he seems to be too great a soul to behave like one. He insists on the ways of the stage conspirator. Now, if a gentleman goes about London in a top hat and a frock coat, no one need know that he is an anarchist. But if a gentleman puts on a top hat and a frock coat and then goes about on his hands and knees, well, he may attract attention. That's what Brother Gogol does. He goes about on his hands and knees with such inexhaustible diplomacy that by this time he finds it quite difficult to walk upright." "I am not good at concealment," said Gogol sulkily with a thick foreign accent. "I am not ashamed of the cause." "Yes, you are, my boy, and so is the cause of you," said the president good-naturedly. "You hide as much as anybody, but you can't do it, you see. You're such an ass. You try to combine two inconsistent methods. When a householder finds a man under his bed, he will probably pause to note the circumstance. But if he finds a man under his bed in a top hat, you will agree with me, my dear Tuesday, that he is not likely even to forget it. Now, when you were found under Admiral Buffin's bed..." "I am not good at deception," said Tuesday, gloomily flushing. "Right, my boy, right," said the president with ponderous heartiness. "You aren't good at anything." While this stream of conversation continued, Syme was looking more steadily at the men around him. As he did so, he gradually felt all his sense of something spiritually queer return. He had thought at first that they were all of common stature and costume, with the evident exception of the hairy Gogol. But as he looked at the others, he began to see in each of them exactly what he had seen in the man by the river, a demonic detail somewhere. That lopsided laugh, which would suddenly disfigure the fine face of his original guide, was typical of all these types. Each man had something about him, perceived perhaps at the 10th or 12th glance, which was not normal and which seemed hardly human. The only metaphor he could think of was this, that they all looked as men of fashion and presence would look, with the additional twist given in a false and curved mirror. Only the individual examples will express this half-concealed eccentricity. Syme's original cicerone bore the title of Monday. He was the secretary of the council, and his twisted smile was regarded with more terror than anything, except the president's horrible, happy laughter. But now that Syme had more space and light to observe him, there were other touches. His fine face was so emaciated that Syme thought it must be wasted with some disease. Yet somehow the very distress of his dark eyes denied this. It was no physical ill that troubled him. His eyes were alive with intellectual torture, as if pure thought was pain. He was typical of each of the tribe. Each man was subtly and differently wrong. Next to him sat Tuesday, the tousle-headed Gogol, a man more obviously mad. Next was Wednesday, a certain Marquis de Saint Eustache, a sufficiently characteristic figure. The first few glances found nothing unusual about him, except that he was the only man at table who wore the fashionable clothes as if they were really his own. He had a black French beard cut square and a black English frock coat cut even squarer. But Syme, sensitive to such things, felt somehow that the man carried a rich atmosphere with him, a rich atmosphere that suffocated. It reminded one irrationally of drowsy odors and of dying lamps in the darker poems of Byron and Poe. With this went a sense of his being clad, not in lighter colors, but in softer materials. His black seemed richer and warmer than the black shades about him, as if it were compounded of profound color. His black frock coat looked as if it were only black by being too dense a purple. His black beard looked as if it were the only black by being too deep a blue. And in the gloom and thickness of the beard, his dark red mouth showed sensual and scornful. Whatever he was not a Frenchman. He might be a Jew. He might be something deeper yet in the dark heart of the East. In the bright-colored Persian tiles and pictures showing tyrants hunting, you may see just those almond eyes, those blue-black beards, those common, cruel lips. Then came Simon, next a very old man, Professor de Worms, who still kept the chair of Friday, though every day it was expected that his death would leave it empty. Save for his intellect, he was in the last dissolution of senile decay. His face was as gray as his long gray beard. His forehead was lifted and fixed financially in a furrow of mild despair. In another case, not even that of Gogol, did the bridegroom brilliancy of the morning dress express a more painful contrast. For the red flower in his buttonhole showed up against a face that was literally discolored like lead. The whole hideous effect was as if some drunken dandies had put their clothes upon a corpse. When he rose or sat down, which was with long labor and peril, something worse was expressed than mere weakness, something indefinably connected with the horror of the whole scene. It did not express decrepitude merely, but corruption. Another hateful fancy crossed Syme's quivering mind. He could not help thinking that whenever the man moved, a leg or arm might fall off. Right at the end sat the man Saturday, the simplest and most baffling of all. He was a short, square man with a dark, square face, clean-shaven, a medical practitioner going by the name of Bull. He had that combination of savoir-faire with a sort of well-groomed coarseness which is not uncommon in young doctors. He carried his fine clothes with confidence rather than ease, and he mostly wore a set smile. There was nothing whatever odd about him except that he wore a pair of dark, almost opaque spectacles. It may have been merely a crescendo of nervous fancy that had gone before, but those black discs were dreadful to Syme. They reminded him of half-remembered ugly tales, of some story about pennies being put on the eyes of the dead. Syme's eye always caught the black glasses and the blind grin. Had the dying professor worn them, or even the pale secretary, they would have been appropriate. But on the younger and grosser man they seemed only an enigma. They took away the key of the face. You could not tell what his smile or his gravity meant. Partly from this, and partly because he had a vulgar virility, wanting in most of the others, it seemed to Syme that he might be the wickedest of all of those wicked men. Syme even had the thought that his eyes might be covered up because they were too frightful to see. Chapter 6. The Exposure. Such were the six men who had sworn to destroy the world. Again and again, Syme strove to pull together his common sense in their presence. Sometimes he saw for an instant that these notions were subjective, that he was only looking at ordinary men, one of whom was old, another nervous, another short-sighted. The sense of an unnatural symbolism always settled back on him again. Each figure seemed to be, somehow, on the borderland of things, just as their theory was on the borderland of thought. He knew that each one of these men stood at the extreme end, so to speak, of some wild road of reasoning. He could only fancy, as in some old world fable, that if a man went westward to the end of the world, he would find something, say a tree, that was more or less than a tree, a tree possessed by a spirit, and that if he went east to the end of the world, he would find something else that was not holy itself, a tower, perhaps, of which the very shape was wicked. So these figures seemed to stand up, violent and unaccountable, against an ultimate horizon, visions from the verge. The ends of the earth were closing in. Talk had been going on steadily as he took in the scene, and not the least of the contrasts of that bewildering breakfast table was the contrast between the easy and unobtrusive tone of talk and its terrible purport. They were deep in the discussion of an actual and immediate plot. The waiter downstairs had spoken quite correctly when he said that they were talking about bombs and kings. Only 3 days afterward, the Tsar was to meet the President of the French Republic in Paris, and over their bacon and eggs upon their sunny balcony, these beaming gentlemen had decided how both should die. Even the instrument was chosen. The black-bearded Marquis, it seemed, was to carry the bomb. Ordinarily speaking, the proximity of this positive and objective crime would have sobered Syme and cured him of all his merely mystical tremors. He would have thought of nothing but the need of saving at least two human bodies from being ripped to pieces with iron and roaring gas. But the truth was that by this time he had begun to feel a third kind of fear, more piercing and practical than either his moral revulsion or his social responsibility. Very simply, he had no fear to spare for the French president or the Tsar. He had begun to fear for himself. Most of the talkers took little heed of him, debating now with their faces closer together and almost uniformly grave, save when for an instant the smile of the secretary ran aslant across his face as the jagged lightning runs aslant across the sky. But there was one persistent thing which first troubled Simon, at last terrified him. The president was always looking at him, steadily, and with a great and baffling interest. The enormous man was quite quiet, but his blue eyes stood out of his head, and they were always fixed on Simon. Simon felt moved to spring up and leap over the balcony. When the president's eyes were on him, he felt as if he were made of glass. He had hardly the shred of a doubt that in some silent and extraordinary way, Sunday had found out that he was a spy. He looked over the edge of the balcony and saw a policeman, standing abstractedly just beneath, staring at the bright railings and the sunlit trees. Then there fell upon him the great temptation that was to torment him for many days. In the presence of these powerful and repulsive men, who were the princes of anarchy, he had almost forgotten the frail and fanciful figure of the poet Gregory, the mere aesthete of anarchism. He even thought of him now with an old kindness, as if they had played together when children. But he remembered that he was still tied to Gregory by a great promise. He had promised never to do the very thing that he now felt himself almost in the act of doing. He had promised not to jump over that balcony and speak to that policeman. He took his cold hand off the stone-cold balustrade. His soul swayed in a vertigo of moral indecision. He had only to snap the thread of a rash vow made to a villainous society, and all his life could be as open and sunny as the square beneath him. He had, on the other hand, only to keep his antiquated honor and be delivered inch by inch into the power of this great enemy of mankind, whose very intellect was a torture chamber. Whenever he looked down into the square, he saw the comfortable policeman, a pillar of common sense and common order. Whenever he looked back at the breakfast table, he saw the president, still quietly studying him with big, unbearable eyes. In all the torrent of his thought, there were two thoughts that never crossed his mind. First, it never occurred to him to doubt that the president and his counsel could crush him if he continued to stand alone. The place might be public, the project might seem impossible. But Sunday was not the man who would carry himself thus easily without having, somehow or somewhere, set open his iron trap. Either by anonymous poison or sudden street accident, by hypnotism or by fire from hell, Sunday could certainly strike him. If he defied the man, he was probably dead. He either struck stiff there in his chair or long afterwards as by an innocent ailment. If he called in the police promptly, arrested everyone, told all, and set against them the whole energy of England, he would probably escape.